school there when I got a call from my cousin. My cousin Shirley. And my cousin Shirley, we grew up about an eighth of a mile from each other, and her and her brother and us, we used to just play together. We had a great time. In fact, she's one of my favorite cousins. She called us up. She had grown up, and she had married a young man who wanted to be a Methodist minister. And they were going to a very prestigious religious seminary on the East Coast. And she called us up and said, "Hey, you know what, let's get together." And, well, I was excited about that. Thought, well, me, that'll be neat. I'll be able to renew our acquaintance with Shirley and Scott, and we'll talk shop, and we'll find out what he's taking and share notes, and we'll just have a great time. So they came to see us over Thanksgiving. Well, it didn't turn out quite like I thought it was should have turned out. As we began to sit down and we started talking, all of a sudden he said to me, he said, "You know, Burton, I don't believe the Bible is God's word." Whoa, man, that's something to me, you know. And he says, "And I don't believe in the creation story. I don't believe in the story of original sin from Adam and Eve. I don't believe in the devil. And I don't even really believe in Jesus Christ. I don't think he's the Son of God." Well, boy, I'll tell you, you know, my Irish came up, which happens once in a while. And I said, "Well, I do. I happen to believe in the Bible. I believe that in God. I believe he created this world like he said he did. I believe in Adam, the story of Adam and Eve. And I believe this, and I believe in Jesus Christ, and I don't think you can have salvation without it. How can you preach, you know?" Well, we got into a very heated argument. And finally, all of a sudden, Shirley said, "You know what? It's starting to snow outside. I think we better leave." And, you know, I was kind of happy to see him go. Well, he went back to his school and graduated and became a Methodist minister. And I graduated from Andrews University and became a Seventh-day Adventist minister. And so here we were, two ministers, totally different concepts and beliefs. The question has to be, though, is why do I believe in God so much, you know? Why is it that I believe in creation? And why do I put so much trust in Jesus Christ, you know? There's a lot of people today that don't believe in God. They don't believe in creation. You know, you've heard the word evolution. And why is it that Christians believe in God? Well, this is what this series basically is about, our awesome God and who he is and what he's done. And remember last week we talked a little bit about why I believe in God. I personally believe in God. In fact, this is just one of the many reasons. But one of the reasons is because of the way that our human bodies have been made. You know, we talked about the eye and we talked about the mind. I'm telling you, there's no way anybody could ever fashion anything that is as fantastic as the eye or the mind. It is the most fantastic computer. The mind is the most fantastic computer. And the eye, man, nobody's been able to invent anything better than the eye, you know? And then we talked about... This book is filled with prophecies. There's hundreds of prophecies in this book. And we brought out the fact that there are two kinds of prophecies, the if prophecies and the ones where God says, "I don't care what, this is what's going to happen." You know, those prophecies are certain, and when they've happened exactly like God said they were going to happen. Just exactly like God said they were going to happen. And you can bank on it. You know, the Bible stakes its whole reputation on those prophecies. It burns all bridges. But as I've studied over those many prophecies, and I haven't studied them all, but boy, when I have, invariably, when they've happened exactly like God said they were going to happen. And last week I pointed out that probably the main reason why I believe in God is because of what he did for me. At the age of 23, in desperation, I asked Jesus to come into my life, and he came in. I tell you, folks, I know that he's there. And he came in, and he's seen me through my last 43 years of life. I know, I'm 66 years old now. But you know, we're in good health and God has blessed us. And who is it? Who can I give credit to it? It's God. I believe in God. Well, we want to pursue this idea of God being the creator a little bit more today. I'd like for you to take your Bibles and turn to Genesis chapter 1. And we talk a little bit more about why I believe that God is the creator or not. And let me just say this, that there is absolutely no positive proof that I can't prove to you that God exists. I want to tell you that. But I believe there's so much evidence in this book that when you apply it to what we're, the way we're living and what's going on in the world, it's very clear that there had to be a mastermind. You know? I want to tell you something else, that even the evolutionists have to have a base of faith. You know, it takes more faith to be an evolutionist than it does to be a Christian. I mean, I remember when I was a kid, they said the earth was 3 million years old. Now they're saying it's 19 billion years old. You know, they keep stretching it out, you know. And I can't prove to you that there is a God. I wasn't there when the world was created. I wasn't there. I didn't hear him talk. I didn't see him do all this thing. But I'll tell you, the evidence is pretty strong. But notice what it says here. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was empty, a formless mass, cloaked in darkness, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the surface. Then God said, let there be light, and there was light, and God saw that it was good. Then he separated the light from the darkness. He called the light day and the darkness night. And this is what it says. In the beginning, God created this world. And I believe that. Now, one of the reasons why I believe it is the way that this whole universe is put together. I want to tell you something. You stop and you study the universe and you have to come to the conclusion that there has to be a mastermind. You take a telescope and you look out into the universe and you see all these hundreds and thousands of galaxies. In fact, I was reading in the National Geographic, they now believe that there are over 100 billion galaxies. Galaxies. And in every galaxy, there are probably 100 billion solar systems, like our solar system, you know. That's what the Bible said. I should say that's what they're saying, you know. And they're saying it's 19 billion years old. We'll come back and talk about that a little bit. But the fact is that when you look at it, you'll discover that in all solar systems, there is a nucleus or there's a sun. There's a sun. And then you have all these little planets running around it. And in our particular solar system, we have Venus and Mars and Jupiter and Saturn and Neptune and Pluto. And what else is there anyhow? What? Uranus and Neptune and... isn't Neptune? Mercury, okay. Got them all, I think. But, you know, you got all this running around there. But if you look out in space, and if you could see, and you see this in pictures, here's another sun, and here's all these little planets running around. Here's another sun, all these little planets running around. And when you look at the galaxy, you see that there's like a core in the galaxy, and all of these solar systems are running around this core. Is that happenstance? I don't think so. I think somebody's a mastermind. They put that thing together. And, you know, and when you take a microscope and you look at the elements of this earth, guess what you see? You see exactly the same thing. You see little suns and with a little neutrons or protons or whatever you might call it, they're circling around, electrons. And they're circling around this core. And the more little Earths that are circling around the sun, the heavier the element is. Like, for instance, hydrogen. It has only one little Earth circling around it. You take Uranus, though, it has over 200 little Earths circling around it. You see? And it's these little Earths circling around the nucleus that gives it its weight. Now, it's exactly the same as the telescope. I remember I was studying in chemistry class when suddenly it dawned upon me. You know, somebody had to be a mastermind to put this whole thing together. It's all built on the same principle. And I tell you, I don't see how we can get away from that. It says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Over here in Colossians chapter 1, verse 16, it tells us that God did it through Jesus. And it says he created everything through Jesus. Now, we'll come back to that in a couple of weeks from now and talk about that. But the fact is, the Bible says it, I believe it. And that pretty well settles it in my mind, you know. Now, I think we need to do research, we need to do study, we need to find out everything we can. It's fascinating to read all this stuff. I love to read about all this universe. But, man, I want to tell you something, folks. When you look at it, the evidence, it's pretty strong in the creation side view. Now, when did God create this? You know, I don't know. I wasn't there. I don't know when he created it. You know, I read, as I said, in National Geographic, 19 billion years ago, you know, he created, or creation came about. Well, I don't know. Maybe it is. I think our God's older than 19 billion years old, you know. But I believe that this earth, and the Bible kind of clears that up. It says here that it was a formless mass. I think it probably was here all the time. But God chose to come down to this earth and make it extra special. Do you know that? That's what my Bible tells me. And he gave this, actually, it was given to Jesus. It was to be his world. And that's why we have the great controversy going on in this world today. Because Satan says, no, I want a world, you know. And there's a big fight going over this world. Now, this world, I don't know how old it is. Some people say it's 6,000 years old. Some people say it's older than that. I don't know. I don't really care. But what I do know is that God created this world. I believe that. And I believe that God has a mastermind for this world, and he's going to come back, and we'll talk about more of that later on. Now, how did he create the world? You know, I just have to go back to what the Bible says over here in Psalms 33. And it's pretty clear over here. Psalms 33, in verses 6 and 9. It says, the Lord merely spoke, and the heavens were created. He breathed the words and all the stars were born. And verse 9 says, when he spoke, the world began. It appeared at his command. It says that God just spoke. He was able to make something out of nothing. Now, I don't know how it happened. You know, as I was reading this National Geographic article, it was really interesting. They were saying they don't understand how all this power came about and all this material came out of this. I said, it's very simple. God did it. You know? Yeah. They won't accept that, though. But, you know, but the fact is we can take something and make it into nothing, can't we? Yeah? We're pretty good at that. And we can blow things to bits, you know? But we can't take nothing and make it into something. We've never been able to do that. You know, they tell this cute little story about this atheist who challenged God. He says, God, I can do anything you can do. And God says, okay, let's see you create. So he reaches down and his atheist grabs a handful of dirt. And God says, wait a minute, you can't use that. I created it. You know? You got to start from nothing. Nobody can do that. But God did. And I accept that, you know? So, now, there's another way that I think that we can, another thing I want to just share with you on about why I believe there's a God. And by the way, if you want to read a fantastic book, this is one of the best books that I have ever read. It's called Seven Mysteries Solved. And it's written by a fellow by the name of Howard Pett. You get this from the Heart right here in Fallbrook. But I'll tell you, this book is fantastic. It's a whole big section on creation here. I read it once before, but I'm reading it again, and I'm telling you, as I read this book, I thought, wow, every Adventist, every Christian ought to read this book. I'm telling you, it is an eye-opener, because he lays out all the different concepts and everything, and when you get through reading this book, you'll know that there is a God. This book is not cheap, but I want to tell you, it is worth its weight in gold. So if you ever wanted, if you want interested, why, CJ here, talk to him about it. He can tell you all about that book. But at any rate, another way that I think that we can, to me, that just points out the fact there had to be a God. And that has to do with reproducing. Now, over here in Genesis, we find a very interesting statement. Reproducing of kind, I should say. Notice in Genesis 1, verse 24, it says, and God said, let the earth bring forth every kind of animal. Notice the word kind. Livestock, small animals, and wildlife. And so it was. God made all sorts of wild animals, livestock, and small animals, each able to reproduce more of its own kind. And God saw that it was good. Now you notice the word kind, and it says reproduce its own kind. Now notice in verse 27... said God, so God created people in his own image, and he patterned them after himself, male and female. He created them. And in verse 20 it says, and God blessed him and told him, multiply and fill the earth and subdue it. Now, I'm going to use a word And that's a word that everybody's... is sex. That one of the best ways that you can prove that there is there had to be a mastermind is what you see in nature and the way people reproduce or way animals reproduce. Now, if you were looking at your biology, maybe you discovered that there was... in the beginning, there was little... Or I should say that when you get down to the simplest form of life, there's what they call protozoas and there's amoebas and stuff like that. And what they are is one-celled animals. And they just divide like that and they become another animal, but they're still one-celled animal. But you come up the level and all of a sudden you discover there has to be a male and a female of the same kind. You get that? Now, how did that happen? And you know, there's so many different kinds. Now, what's that saying is that a dog can't mate with a cat. It won't produce anything. An elephant can't mate with a giraffe. You won't get anything. A gorilla can't mate with whatever it is, a human being. You can't get it. It has to be a human being mate for the human being in order to have it. And you have the male and female. Now, let's say that the evolutionists are right on this thing. And that if we did evolve. Do you know that is absolutely ridiculous thinking when you stop to think about it? That'd be what you call macro evolution. But it would have to be macro evolution times two. Now, for instance, let's say the two apes. They say we came from apes. So two apes fall in love with one another, a male and a female, and they marry each other, and they have a little offspring. And all of a sudden, that offspring is a human being. You know, that's what they're saying. He's a human being, you know. And let's say the offspring is a male. But there's a problem. There's only one male. There's only one human being. What's going to happen to the human being race? It's going to die out. The only way it could be possible is all of a sudden another ape, two apes get married, and they have a child, and all of a sudden, about the same time and same location, there's a female is born, a female human being. And the two of them get together and they start the human race. That, you know, that is, when you work out the odds, it is astronomical. It is an impossibility. And yet they're saying this happened all down through the ages. You know, the male giraffe and the female giraffe, you know, and the male lion, the female lion, and all this, you know. That's what they're saying has happened. No wonder they keep stretching it back to 19 billion years. You know? There's no way. When you look at it now, there's been microevolution. I want to tell you that. You know, there's been a variation within the species. But I want to tell you something. There's never been able to find any key to a macroevolution where a lion all of a sudden becomes a dog or a fish becomes a human, you know, becomes a land animal. They can't find it. It's not there. That to me tells me that there is a God. Somebody masterminded this. And my Bible says that God did it. So God created humans in his own image, patterned them after himself, male and female, he created them. And again, I want to say this. If God said it, I guess I'm dumb enough to believe it, and that basically settles it. Now, if this is so, the question has to be asked is, why in the world doesn't the rest of the world be able to see this? I mean, we have this preponderance of evidence that there is a God, and yet we choose... people that today, even theologians, choose not to believe it. You know, over here in Romans chapter 1, verse 18, we find Paul kind of tackling this problem. Romans chapter 1, verse 18. And he talks about how God is really upset about all this. And I'm just going to read a few of the verses here because it just points out what the problem is. He says, but God shows his anger from heaven against all sinful, wicked people who push away the truth from themselves. In other words, they push the truth away. For the truth about God is known to them instinctively. God has put this knowledge in their hearts. And from the time the world is created, people have seen the earth and the sky and all that God made. They can clearly see his invisible qualities, his eternal power, divine nature, so they have no excuse whatsoever for not knowing God. He says, there's all kinds of proof out there, you know, about the fact that there is a God. Now, I'm reading to you out of New Living Translation, This is a good translation. It's a good reading translation. To me, I mentioned last week, the best translation there is New American Standard Bible. You want to really get something that's factual. That's what you want to get. But what I like about this translation is it's readable. It's understandable. But he said they basically push God out of the picture. And why do they push him out? Because they don't want to worship him as God. Now, that's the big problem. They don't want to worship him as God. You know, basically what the big problem is hardness of the heart. They want to do their will, their way, and they don't want God telling them how to do it. Because if you accept God as a creator, then it means that you're going to have to eventually accept his rules and his regulations. Isn't that right? And that's the problem we have in this world. Over here in Matthew chapter 19. Matthew chapter 19, we find Jesus had quite a discussion with some Pharisees. They came to Jesus, and they wanted to know, in verse 3, should a man be allowed to divorce his wife for any reason? Now, what I think is really interesting is that when you go back to the creation story, you discover that there's two things that came down from creation to this time of ours right now. Two, we can bank on it. Number one is marriage. God performed the first marriage. He intended for a man and a woman to get together and then to have a family. And he said, I want you to multiply and I want you to subdue and take over the world. That was God's plan. And another thing is the Seventh-day Sabbath. And do you know that Satan is Adam? He hates both of those things. Today he's out to destroy families. I'm telling you, he's working overtime. He wants to destroy this. Well, anything that God has put out, he wants to destroy it. And so here we find these people coming, and they're saying, should a man be allowed to divorce his wife for any reason? Jesus answers, haven't you read the scriptures? They record that from the beginning God made them male and female, and he said, this explains why a man leaves his father and his mother and is joined to his wife, and the two are united into one. Since they are no longer two but one, let no one separate them, for God has joined them together. So he said, no, there's no reason for you to get a divorce, you know? And then they came back and said, then why did Moses say a man could merely write an official letter of divorce and send her away? And in verse 8, Jesus replied, it is because of the hardness of your hearts. There's the problem. Why people won't accept what God asked them to do. They won't accept God as the creator because they have hard hearts. They don't want to worship him. They want to do their own thing. You know, when I was pastoring this particular church, I'd just gone there, unpacking my stuff, and all of a sudden this lady arrives, who turns out to be the head deaconess in the church. And she came and said, could I have a few minutes? And I said, sure. So we sat down. And she said, I am divorcing my husband. And I'm going to marry so-and-so. And I'm going to give you some fake names. She said, I'm going to marry George. And he's divorcing his wife to marry me. And would you be willing to perform the wedding? Well, I said to her, you know, I can't do that, but if I could do it, I wouldn't do it. And more than that, and if you folks persist in doing what you're doing, it'll mean that we'll have to take your name off the church books. We can't let that. Oh, she was so upset, she even left in a huff. And so, about 2 days later, here's George on my front porch. I want to talk to you, Pastor. I said, sure. And so we sat down, and he said, I have never loved my wife, and so I don't figure that I'm legally married to her. I said, what? I said, you married her? Why'd you marry if you didn't love her? Well, I felt sorry for her. I said, you married your wife. And by the way, you had a lovely wife and 3 children. And I said, you felt sorry for your wife? That's why you married? Yep. I said, I have a hard time with that one. And he said, I said, how'd you have 3 children if you didn't love your wife? Well, she wanted them. I finally gave in. I thought, man, I can't believe this, you know. Well, it turned out, finally I realized this man needed a relationship with Jesus. So I gave him a little gospel presentation about who Jesus was. And at the very end of it, I said, now listen, would you like to ask Jesus to come in your life and take over? And this is what he said to me. He said, no, I can't do that, Pastor. If I do that, that'll mean that I can't do what I want to do, and I'm going to do what I want to do. Now, you know something? That's hardness of the heart. You know? It's possible to be a church member and have a hard heart. You know, it's possible to be a Seventh-day Adventist and have a hard heart. I want to tell you, folks, hard-heartedness can destroy you. It will destroy you. And that's the problem we have in our world. People wanting to do their own thing, their own way, and so they're willing to throw God out. And it's not a three-way thing. It's an either-or situation. You either accept God as the creator of this world, and then you wind up serving God and realizing that His way is the best way, or you're going to wind up in deep trouble, and you're going to wind up doing your own thing. You know, the Bible tells us, and it's brought out in this book also, that human beings are the only creature that have built within them this idea that they've got to worship something, you know. And you're going to wind up worshiping something, some god of this world, whether it be the gods of wood or stone or whatever it might be, or most of us wind up worshiping our own god. We set ourselves up as God, and we make our own rules and our own regulations, and you know, that ends in disaster. Now, let's take a couple of minutes and let's just take a look at what the Bible points out happens to a person when they set up false gods in their life. Let's go back to Romans chapter 1. Romans chapter 1. We won't take long on this, but I want you to know, start with verse 18. And here he has the seven steps down to destruction. And I'm just going to go through them real quick. He says the first one is you refuse to worship God. And then if you go to verse 22, he says the next thing that happens, he says you're claiming to be wise, you become utter fools instead. When you take and you refuse to worship God, eventually you're going to become foolish. You might think you're pretty smart, but you actually become a fool, he says. And then he says the next step is that they do all kinds of shameful things to themselves, you know? And you see that all the time, you know. And then he says in verse 26, he says, then homosexuality comes in, and you begin to think that's right. And you start doing all kinds of homosexual things that are totally against God. But you justify it. And then you finally, in verse 28, he says, you finally come to the place where you refuse to acknowledge God. And he says, he abandons them through their evil minds and lets them do things that should never be done. Their lives become full of every kind of wickedness and sin and greed and hate and envy and murder. And he goes on listing all these things. Boy, you sure see that happening today, don't you? When you take your eyes off of God and refuse to acknowledge Him as the master of this universe, the creator of this world, you're going to go down that slippery path. And you're going to wind up in deep trouble. And last but not least, he says in verse 32, he said, they are fully aware of God's penalty, death penalty, for those who do these things, yet they go right ahead and do them anyway. Have you seen people do that? And yet, worse yet, he says, they encourage others to do them. They suck other people into their sin, and they get other people doing these things. That's the road to perdition. You start with just taking your eyes off of God and refusing to acknowledge Him as the God, and you set up other gods in your life. You're going to do it. And when you do that, if you take your eyes off of God, you're eventually going to hurt everybody around you, and your family and everybody. And you're going to wind up destroying yourself. You see it all the time. Come back to the story about this fellow that comes to see me, and he said, I'm going to do it. I don't want to give my life to God because I'm going to do what I want to do. And, you know, well, guess what? He divorced his wife, left his three kids. She divorced her husband, left her two kids, and they got married. We had to take their name off the church books. About 2 years later, all of a sudden I come home, and here's George in my front yard, sitting there in his car. He said, I want to talk to you, Pastor. I said, oh, man, what's this about? So I go in, I sit in the car, and we're talking, and he says, Pastor, I just want to tell you that I left Martha. I said, you what? He said, I left Martha. I said, why did you leave her? Well, you told me I shouldn't have married her in the first place. Give me a break. left Martha, married another woman. Married to her about 3 years and left her, married another woman. Last time I heard, he was on his fifth wife. You know? And he left heartbreak all the way along. His kids were damaged. You know that? You take your eyes off the God of this world and you begin setting yourself up as your own God, and you're going to be in deep trouble. My cousin, Shirley and Scott, he became a Methodist minister. And we had a family reunion. And remember, we got together and we were talking. And Shirley said to us, she said, you know, I don't understand it. Every place that we go and we pastor, the church, the membership goes way down and people stop coming. But I know why. You don't believe in God, why even go to church, you know? Well, he got into pushing homosexual issues in his church. And in fact, he was kind of like the ringleader in the Methodist church, and he was pushing this homosexual issue. He was instrumental in getting it to the general conference, and he had a great big debate. I remember when I was, you know, reading about that, I thought, oh man, what's my cousin doing now, you know? But he got into this thing. Now, they had two lovely children, but when they were still small, one day he comes home and he says to my cousin Shirley, I'm leaving you. Why was he leaving her? Because he found another Episcopal minister that he loved. And so the Episcopal minister left his wife. Scott left Shirley. And they're now living in San Francisco. You get my drift? And both families are terribly hurt, you know? When you take your eyes off the creator of this world and you set up your own gods and you begin doing your own thing, your will, your way, you're asking for great trouble. And it all starts with this idea, who is the creator of this world? That's where it's all at. You don't acknowledge God as the creator of this world, you're going to have trouble. Over here in Joshua chapter 24, Joshua chapter 24, we find a really a neat little story here, a sermon. Joshua is now an old man, about 120 years old, or 110. And he knows his time is running out, and he started off in Egypt, you remember? And he was a part of the group that came out of Egypt into the wilderness, and he was a part of the 10 or the 12 spies that went in. And then finally he became the leader of Israel, and he was there when they went into the promised land. But he's old now, and he knows what's happening. He sees it. So he calls the people together for one last sermon. And boy, what a sermon he gives. He tells them, he said, hey, I want you to talk about what God has done, how great God is. Look, he brought us out of Egypt. He brought us through the wilderness. He brought us into the promised land. And when he gets all done with his sermon, he says in verse 14, so honor the Lord and serve him wholeheartedly. Put away forever the idols your ancestors worshiped when they lived beyond the Euphrates River and in Egypt. Serve the Lord alone. But if you're unwilling to serve the Lord, then choose today whom you will serve. Would you prefer the gods your ancestors served beyond the Euphrates? Or will it be the gods of the Amorites in whose land you now live? But as for me and my house, my family, we will serve the Lord. You know what? We all have to make choices. And today is the day of choice. I believe that the God of this world, the one that created this world, also created me. And I believe since he's my creator, he sets the rules and he gives the laws. And my job is to worship him by obeying him, not by doing my own thing. And when I violate what God asked me to do, I'm going to get in deep trouble. But every one of us in this room have to make that decision on our own. You can be an Adventist and still be selfish and and hard-hearted. It has to do with having Jesus as your total leader and total boss. And so today, as we close this sermon, what I want us to do is we're going to have a little call after we get through here. There might be somebody in this church. I know most of you folks already have given your life to Jesus. You've asked Christ to come in and take over, and you mean it, and you're there. But there might be someone here this morning. You know that down deep in your life that you're having some struggles. You've been enticed by some false gods, and you're not where you should be with your relationship with Jesus. And we're going to give you an opportunity, if God is speaking to you, to come and renew your vows to Jesus. I think it's important that we do this. Now, here's what we're going to do. We're going to sing that little song. You notice in your bulletin, our closing song is Awesome God. Our God is an awesome God. You notice on the back of the bulletin here, right where it has the combined budget, the song is there. And I want us to sing it twice